Welcome to Next on the Tee with Chris Mascaro, where tour players, legends, and the top instructors in the game share their stories, insights, and playing lessons. Join Chris every week as he talks with the greats of the game.
You are the smartest guy I've spoken to on radio or television in my career.
And Chris, again, you're knocking out of the park. You're like 8 under par in this interview.
By having any research, I'm hiring your tail to be the research man. You're the best.
You're a fantastic host and tremendously respected in the golf community.
Yeah, Chris, you do an amazing job, and your listeners are super lucky to have you, and it's always my pleasure.
Chris Mascaro is the king of the golf podcast. Don't miss him on Tuesdays.
Now, here's your host, Chris Mascaro.
Good evening, folks, and happy holiday season to all of you, and thank you so much for coming back and joining me this week on the final episode of 2023 of Next on the Tee. I'm your host, Chris Mascaro. You'll hear me say this a lot tonight, but the final episode each season is one I put a little extra thought into because the show is going to be off for a couple of weeks as we all put the focus where it should be on celebrating the holidays with our family and friends. So I want the last voices you'll hear to be ones that are going to resonate with you over the time that we're apart. So I wanted to bring in some people who are very special, ones that have done some great things out there, whether it's in our game or associated with our game, plus folks that are outstanding people, just as individuals, wonderful people that mean a lot to me and I hope become very special to you as well. And I think I've done that. Leading off tonight's show is going to be Mitch Lawrence. You know how much I love the Lawrence brothers. I had the privilege of finally meeting Mitch in person earlier this year. He is such a joy to spend time with. Tonight, I'm going to get his thoughts on all the craziness going on right now in our game. And I want to get his unique perspective because, as you may remember, Mitch almost exclusively plays hickories. So rolling back the golf ball isn't going to mean much to him. But as a historian, what does he think about it? Plus, everything going on in our game right now with LIV Golf, the PGA Tour, trust issues, John Rahm leaving to take millions, hundreds of millions of dollars to go over to LIV. How much is that going to impact Mitch's desire to watch golf on TV? We'll find out when he joins me here in just a few minutes. Following him, I'll be joined by the guy who has produced the greatest sports documentaries and films of this or any other time, and that is Ross Greenberg. Speaking about a guy that means a tremendous amount to me, Ross has been so fantastic over the years as part of this show, plus Thursday Night Tailgate, our show over on the football side. Ross was the president of HBO Sports back in the 80s and the 90s. He was responsible for their shows Inside the NFL, HBO World Championship Boxing. He was there for the Mike Tyson-Buster Douglas fight. Later, he did documentaries for the USGA on Jack Nicklaus, particularly the 1962 U.S. Open and the great battle between Jack and Arnie. He also did one on the 1991 Ryder Cup, the War at the Shore, and the 1999 U.S. Open won by Payne Stewart. So a ton of things to get into with Ross tonight. He'll join me about 25 minutes from now. And later on, we'll round out the show with former PGA Tour pro David Peoples. He'll be making his Next on the Tee debut with me. David played his college golf at the University of Florida. He won twice on the PGA Tour, plus the 1990 Kapalua Invitational, which for some reason wasn't a sanctioned tour event by the PGA at the time, but what a tremendous field he beat that week. David and I have lived star-crossed lives. We both lived in Winter Park, Florida at one time. We both lived in Germantown, Tennessee, which where he still lives today. One of my childhood friends works for his wife, which we discovered earlier today as we were texting back and forth. So I'm very excited that I get to have David as part of the show with me. He'll join me about 45 minutes from now. So a lot of great stuff in store for you tonight on the final episode of 2023 of Next on the Tee. And as always, thank you so much for tuning in and taking the journey with me tonight. Before we get started, our resident director of instruction, Tom Patry, and I have been working with a company called Kickpoint. And they have done some magical things with our logos and created some polo shirts with some wonderful designs where they take our logos and turn them into designs on a polo shirt. They're absolutely outstanding. Kickpoint Golf is a private label custom golf apparel company making bespoke polo shirts, quarter zips, and hoodies for those selected clubs looking to take their branded game to a whole new level. If you want to check out their apparel, and again, it's going to knock your socks off, send an email to info@kickpointgolf.com. They'll get right back to you. There's no middleman. They're going to go right to the guys that do this work. You're going to check it out, and you are really going to love what they do. I'm going to start showing the polo shirts that they designed for me on my Instagram, @CTMascaro. Check them out there so you can get a sample of what they look like. These guys know where it's at. Now let's talk about golf getaways and buddy's trip locations. When you're thinking about that, think about our friends over at the Macklemore, which is a wonderful resort located just south of Chattanooga, Tennessee, high atop Lookout Mountain. It is a casual two-hour drive from Atlanta, Nashville, and Birmingham. The existing Highlands course is now ranked in the top 100 courses you can play in the U.S. by Golf Digest. The 18th hole is ranked in the top 10 finishing holes in the world. A second course, The Keep, is under construction and will open summer of 2024. The Keep is a Bill Bergen, Reese Jones design and features a mile and a half of dramatic cliff edge, with every inch of that edge filled up with a golf hole. A world-class hotel, Cloudland Lookout Mountain Curio Collection by Hilton, will open spring of 2024. Both have incredible views into historic Macklemore Cove, 1,200 feet below. You got to see it to believe it, folks. Stay, dine, and play golf above the clouds at Macklemore. Go online to macklemore.com to book your stay and play package. Now let's talk grips. I want to tell you about Lambkin grips. Every shot, as you know, has its own unique feel. The trick? Feel comfortable with each one. And comfort is built into the very DNA of Sonar Plus Black Grips. Composed of their Genesis material that provides supreme comfort and durability, with their fingerprint technology, creates a strong connection and unforgettable touch. The game changes from shot to shot. The feel on your hand shouldn't. Lambkin. Feel is everything. I also want to remind you about the all-new Stealth 2 driver from TaylorMade. If there's one thing we know golfers want from a driver, it's distance. But there's actually two things we all want. Distance, and let's not forget, forgiveness. That's why TaylorMade designed the Stealth 2 driver with even more carbon for even more forgiveness. To learn more about the new Stealth 2 driver from TaylorMade, visit them online at TaylorMadeGolf.com. Okay, now back with me is one of the great people you get to meet in this life, and certainly one of the best individuals in our game, and that is Mitch Lawrence. For years, Mitch hosted a great podcast called Talking Golf Getaways. He is one of the great experts in our game on golf history and Hickory Golf Clubs. If you were to ask me, who would you put in your dream foursome? For sure, Mitch Lawrence and his brother Matthew would be two of them. Our game is better because Mitch has been involved in it. And every year when it comes to the final episode of the season, I put a lot of thought into whose voice do I want to leave you with? And this guy's name always pops into my head right away because there are just none better. Good evening, Mitch. How are you, my friend?
I don't know what to say. My face is red. I'm blushing. I thought I knew you. And every time we do this show and every time I get to hear your voice, I just I couldn't echo that sentiment more, man. I couldn't be happier and more grateful to be your friend and to close out another year talking to you about the game we love. So thank you. That.
Absolutely. So, Mitch, when you reflect back on the evolution that you've seen in our game since you started playing, and I know you took up the game a little bit later in life, but the things that you have seen from the evolution of the golf clubs, from the evolution of the golf ball, from the distances being added to golf courses, what are your thoughts about what you see now versus what you saw then?
It's such an interesting question. And obviously, there's so much going on with the game right now, Chris. And I started playing when I was 30, in 1980. And up until very recently, and sadly, there's so much in the world that falls into this category. I never in the 40 plus years now, almost 44 years, that I've been involved with it actively and passionately. I feel like there's so much swirling that has nothing to do with the game. And that's the biggest takeaway for me. I think, you know, everybody who plays, everybody who watches, everybody has a different perspective. Everybody has a different level of skill. As we know, I'm reminded of it all the time. But everybody approaches all these things in a different way. The difference now is that because of social media, we all know a lot of the time, unwillingly or certainly in a way that's not particularly wanted, how a lot of people feel. We get to see it all the time, which we never used to until the advent of all of this. And I think that throws even more confusion into it. When I look back on the game the way it was over the last 40-something years, and then for certainly there's been, through the eras of golf and all the different iterations of the game, there have been, discussions and arguments and differences of opinion about some of the things that we're talking about. You know, we talk about the rollback of the ball and all that goes into that, and there's so many different ways of looking at it. Those discussions have happened before in the game. The ball has always been, a source of kind of interest and speculation, and it's just always been there. It's changed over the years. I mean, I remember going up to Banff in Canada and playing what's now Fairmont Banff Springs, which is one of the truly great golf courses, Stanley Thompson course. And it was in the 80s, so I hadn't been playing that long. And I got up there, and when I got there, they gave me the balls that they sold in the pro shop were the European balls, which were smaller. And it was the first time I had ever played one, and really the first time that I had any experience with using a different ball than the one we played in America. So this kind of discussion has been going on. What do we do? What don't we do? What do we allow? What don't we allow? But what it's brought me back to, and this is just my perspective, with all the noise about it, about the tour and LIV Golf, about all these different subjects, is that I don't want to get away from the game I love. The ball issues don't impact me. And I think for a lot of amateur golfers, they will not impact them. There are definitely players that it will impact in a certain way, but I don't want to spend my time worrying about that or focusing on it. First of all, since the effective date is 2030, which is 6 years from now. When that takes effect, I'll be 80. That's my plan. So I have a very different view of all this. I don't believe that these issues, certainly John Rahm making $400 million, does not impact my life in any way. So though I enjoy discussing things with friends, or it has no real impact. And so what I'm trying to do now is turn off that noise, frankly, because the other day I went out on Friday and got a chance to play with our mutual great friend, Jack Curry.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And we went out. There's a charity in Myrtle Beach and in the Southeast called All Four Paws. And they had a fundraising day, and we got our dog through that great rescue operation. And it was a team scramble, and I asked Jack and his wife, Joanne, if they wanted to join me, and they said, yeah. We played Caledonia, which, as you know, is one of my favorite places on the planet here in Myrtle Beach. And Jack and I were talking about it during the day. And we were just talking about all that and reminding each other that the actual important thing was what we were doing. Being with friends, playing golf, hitting shots, laughing, trying to get better, even though we knew the chances of that happening during a particular round weren't that great. But that kind of realization is what I keep trying to feel all the time now. And I know you're a grateful guy, and just being grateful for the game we have and not get lost in all the things that don't really affect us. Certainly they affect a lot of people. There's, manufacturers and the tour, and it affects people. I get it. But on a very, I won't say selfish, because I don't think of it as being selfish. I think of it as being reminded of what's important.
So let's take that last part a little bit further, because to your point, none of this really impacts or affects most of us. Now, I would say where it might start to impact us or affect us is our desire to watch the PGA Tour and to watch golf. Because to your point, this is all going to happen to us 6 years from now. 2027 in October, we won't be able to buy the same golf ball that we buy today. But it is years into the future and a lot can happen. But where I think this could start impacting all of us is our desire to continue to watch the PGA Tour. With all the craziness, with LIV, partnerships with the PIF, trust, who do we believe, who lied to who, all that sort of stuff can taint the PGA Tour and impact our desire to turn it on a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, or Sunday. Is that a place where it might actually affect you?
100%. 100%. And that's the way that it does affect us. And I'm glad you brought it up because it's a really valid point. I mean, there's two things. One is, as you know, I'm a Hickory player. So the discussion about the ball really means nothing to me. I've been playing a replica, you know, golf ball from the 1920s for the last 15 years. It doesn't go far. I play 100-year-old clubs. They don't go far. My body is 74. It doesn't go far. So, you know, that part of it is I've kind of checked out of that. But as far as watching it, there is no question that I am most times now not interested. And I think a lot of that is a byproduct of everything that's going on. I mean, I went from being a guy who back in the days of VHS tapes, literally taped every tournament, all four rounds of every tournament, and would then watch them. I was completely obsessed with watching golf. And fast forward to now, and with very few exceptions, most of that being watching a lot more of the LPGA, which I really like watching, and the stories that surround golf, which I'll catch on Twitter or, you know, my friend Ryan French, who does all the Monday Q stuff, the stories that he tells about players trying to get their cards, or I'm much more interested in that stuff, in the stories of the game, than I am in watching. And I know the players they're as great as they were. They're amazing to watch. But I think a lot of people are really feeling this way. And that is that if it's a major, I'll probably tune in the first couple of days. And if I feel compelled, I'll watch over the weekend. I was lucky enough this year to go to the Ryder Cup in Italy, in Rome. And it was an unreal experience, the experience of being around people in that kind of atmosphere and a team competition and all that goes along with that. Yeah, I'll watch that because it's a different story. Otherwise, for me, at this point, when I think back on the last year, and I wonder how you feel, the times I really wanted to watch were the compelling stories. I mean, the PGA and watching Michael Block and, you know, those kinds of stories, I went, wow, I'm watching this. Because otherwise, I'm just not as interested. And I think it's a great point you bring up. The danger is that people who once loved just watching the best players in the world play the game are probably not as interested because of all the, as we said, of all the noise.
Yeah, and I tell you kind of where I stand. I mean, forever, and not just in the game of golf, when you talk to a lot of the great players, they talked about how they played the game for the love of the game. You know, Kevin Costner, right? But now with LIV and guys getting paid hundreds of millions of dollars to defect, and you mentioned the Ryder Cup, and, you know, we all know about the Patrick Cantlay thing, and, you know, did he not wear the hat in protest? Did he, you know, want to get paid to play in the Ryder Cup? Those kinds of things to me take away from the game because what that tells me is for some of the bigger players in our game, it is all about the money. It's all about the money. It isn't about the love of the game. It certainly isn't about the fans. It's all about me. And I know golf is a selfish sport. There isn't a team out there for the most part. I know LIV Golf has its teams and stuff like that. It isn't a team event, so you got to be out there and you've got to be myopically focused in order to win golf tournaments, particularly majors. But it has taken away some of, I don't know, you want to call it innocence, whatever. It has taken away some of my love of the game at the PGA Tour level, not at the, as you talk about, the grassroots level and us hanging out and playing and my buddies and I going out and playing and having a good time together. That to me is still intact. But the PGA Tour has really, I think, fallen in my eyes because it's no longer about, I want to win majors. I want to have a legacy. It's all about, I want my money.
Yeah. And I think the best example is, and that to me, I mean, I don't begrudge anybody money. I don't begrudge them making a living. We watch other sports. You know, I watch football in the NFL and talk about baseball, and all of a sudden you've got Shohei Ohtani going on with $400 million for this and for, you know, all that stuff is still going on. I remember having a conversation. There was a great Giant, New York Giants football great named Alex Webster. And I got to play in a whole bunch of celebrity tournaments with him. And we were having dinner one night and we started talking about the money. And he said, do you know, and he was on the New York Giants championship teams. These guys were great. I mean, Y.A. Tittle, Frank Gifford, those years. He said to me, do you know that not one season went by, even when we won a championship, where I didn't have to have a second job in the offseason?
Yeah.
And he was one of the best players in the game for years. And I think about Phil's fall from grace, no matter what you think about LIV or should there be a world tour or whatever, the politics of it has gotten so nasty. When Phil, and I guarantee you, your listeners think this in some sense, it was hard to think of a time when I was more excited about watching a golf tournament than watching Phil win the PGA Championship at Kiawa. It was absolutely riveting, all of it to me, the whole scenario, him against Brooks, him at his age, Kiawa, the whole thing. And how quickly that went from, I revered him. I kept looking up to him and going, and I know he'd had issues before, but the fall from that perspective, because of whatever his, you know, motives are, they're Phil's motives, they're, I don't care. But that fall to me is kind of emblematic of the whole thing. So when John Rahm says, I had enough money before, and he spent a year and a half saying that. And then all of a sudden to go, I want to grow the game. Okay, great. But a whole lot of people don't believe him, which is, I think, what you're saying. Mm-hmm. And why I keep, and a lot of people keep looking back to the greats of the game from the past, who, like you said, were playing because they grew up loving the game. They love the competition. They love the level of play. And I feel like that it's really hard to find people who somehow we can trust that that's what it's still about. I guess that's, and it does make me sad.
So let's take one of those last words that you said, trust. Mm-hmm. I think that is what has been broken in the game. I think trust has been broken between the guys at the Jay Monahan level and the players. Trust has been broken between the players and fans because we've heard people tell us all the things that we wanted to hear. And then, like John Rahm, a few months later, have gone back against what they said. I'll never forgive Jay Monahan for how he stood up with the families from 9/11 and told them how much he was in their corner and how bad it was for people to go over and take the Saudi money, only to theoretically take the Saudi money. Now, that deal hasn't been finalized, but he went behind everybody's back to try to make that deal.
Right.
And so that trust has been broken for me at both levels, between the players and us as fans, between the organization and the fans, between the players and the organization.
Yeah.
That to me is the worst thing that has happened because now we don't know who to trust.
Yeah, I totally, that's exactly how I feel. So that's why it's important as we end this year, Chris, to people who are glass half full people, to go back to why we love the game. And maybe it's a good thing for that, because it's really going to force people in a certain way to remember why the game is so compelling. It's because we play it. It's because we love playing it and all the circumstances around it. I got to take two trips this year with great friends to unbelievable destinations, and spend time with them and hang out with them. And, you know, getting to see your face in person was a highlight.
I can't imagine why.
Well, it was. I was just you and I sitting on the back on the porch at Caledonian talking.
I know.
I mean, those connections are, that's the stuff of life to me now. And I cherish those friendships, and I cherish the game for giving me those friendships. Every great thing in my life as I sit in my house came to me because of golf. I met my wife because of golf. Where I live is because of golf. Most of the friends I have now that I'm close to are from golf. So I'm going back to that stuff, man. And 2024 will be even stronger when it comes time to remember why I'm playing the game and why I love it.
So let's talk about something more positive in the last few minutes that we have together. You mentioned going to Italy for a Ryder Cup. I can't imagine what that was like to be in that kind of atmosphere. What was your Ryder Cup experience?
Well, the great thing to me was about going over there to see it, frankly, was, I mean, there's all the stuff about the Ryder Cup. You're incredibly in awe of them setting it up and what it takes to actually have an event like that. And I mean, I could go on about the way they set it up, but not the course, but just everything around it. I went to the practice round, but when I walked in Friday morning at 6:15, along with about 50,000 other people, you walk past that behind the first tee, and that whatever they built behind that first tee, which from the outside they made kind of look like the Coliseum. And at 6:15 in the morning, which was an hour and 15 minutes before the first shot was hit, you could hear the entire first tee stands were filled with fans, most of them European. And you could hear they were already singing inside. And it was surreal. And I turned to these friends of mine that I was with, and I literally said to them, "We're done." Those were my words. And once I got inside, and this goes back to kind of what we were talking about, I went around the course. We went to different spots and got to stands before the groups got there so we could sit and watch it on a big screen and the whole thing. But sitting in the middle of the European fans during that event, it just told me a lot. It really told me a lot about why it's so important to them. And it's a cultural thing. You know, they grew up with this. The players grew up revering Seve. He was their guy, and you feel that stuff. And I thought they were incredibly respectful. You know, they went crazy for the Europeans, but when an American player hit a great shot, they applauded. You know, and I hate to bring it back to this, but my fear is what Bethpage is going to be like in the next one. Because I don't think it's going to be, will there be fun? Yeah. But I have a little trepidation about where it's going. But Italy was fantastic. The venue was amazing. The people, it was, I'll never forget it. I really will never forget it. And I'm really, really glad that my wife and I got a chance to go.
So one of the things, and you've not only done Talking Golf Getaways, you've done several golf-related podcasts, and you have been immersed in our game for all the years that you talked about earlier. If you had an opportunity to put together a roundtable of whether it's legends that are no longer with us or people in the game today, who would you want to sit down with and talk to, and what would you want to ask them?
Oh, that's a tough question, Chris, because I literally have been so lucky over the years to talk to so many amazing people. I would include, I did a podcast with Peter Thompson. He was in Australia. I talked to him. Absolutely amazing guy, David Graham. I mean, I got to talk to people like that. I would love to have both of those at the table. I think somebody like Annika to get a perspective on the women's game, who I got to talk to, a mutual, great, great mutual friend of ours, Ben Wright. You know, I long for his voice. I did three or four podcasts with Peter Alice. Those are the people that I would want to talk to just for perspective and humor, certainly in the case of the last two. You know, and I guess the people that I love in this game, you know, in this time, in this place in my life, I would want to have the people around me at a round. It would be a big round table, Chris. You'd be there.
I appreciate that.
My brother would be there. My wife would be there. I think that a mixture of people who had the perspective of really being at the top of the game in historic times and the people that I love that I play with now, you know, and kind of have over the years.
Mitch, before I let you go, remind our listeners, how can we stay up to date with you and all the great things that you're out there continuing to do in and around our game, whether we're following you online or it's on social media?
Well, most of the time now, Darren and I and Chris McEwen, we still do what we call special edition Talking Golf Getaways. We did one a couple of months ago about our trip to Sand Valley, which was five amazing days. We're about to do another one at the beginning of January with Patrick Koenig. If you follow Patrick Koenig on Twitter, he set the Guinness World Record for rounds of golf in 1 year. Which is now in the 550 something rounds of golf a year. I just played his 10,000th hole this year. Jeez. So we're going to do a special one with Patrick, who's one of the great people in the game. And that'll be on Golf Trip X through Golf Newsnet. Ryan Ballingy's great Golf Newsnet at Got Newsnet on Twitter and Instagram, golfnewsnet.com. And as far as I go, it's just my biggest contacts, and the there's a lot of bad about it, but there's a lot of great about it when it comes to being with people, and that's just Twitter, which is at Mitch Lawrence. So that's how I still get it and still connect with people. And you know, it's gotten a little slower relative to what I'm doing in the game, but I still throw my hat in the ring every now and then.
Well, Mitch, like I said at the top, if I'm going to leave my listeners with just a few voices until the start of season number 11, I absolutely want one of those voices that reverberates in their minds to be yours, because you're a treasure, my friend. I'm so lucky that I get to call you that.
Well, I appreciate that, Chris. You know, I feel the same way about you. I love you, man.
Right back at you, my friend.
Happy 2024, pal. I'll see you again this year.
I'm looking forward to that. Happy holidays to you and yours. We'll catch up soon.
Okay. Thanks, Chris.
See you, Mitch. That is the great Mitch Lawrence, and I just love that guy. Everything about him. He is just one of the most wonderful individuals that you will meet in life. He's a kind person. He's certainly more knowledgeable about the game of golf and its history than I am, than most people are. He's just a fountain of great information. But aside from the game of golf, like I say, he is just one of the most wonderful individuals that I've been blessed to meet in any walk of life, not just in the game of golf, but just any walk of life. So I'm so thankful to have him as a friend. So thankful he has been on the show 14 times, including tonight. And I certainly hope I get to be in his presence again in 2024. Coming up next is going to be one of the most talented and special individuals on the planet, and certainly in the world of filmmaking, and that is Ross Greenberg. Before I get to Ross, I was talking with Eddie Dry, VP of Domestic Sales for Strixon Cleveland Golf, at the PGA Merchandise Show earlier this year, and I said, Eddie, I like your CBX full-face wedges. How can they help an average player like me play better? Here's what he had to say.
An average player, I use one, and I'm in some lies that you can't even believe. And I need all the help I can get. And the face is bigger, and the grooves go all the way up and all the way out to the toe. So if you hit it on the toe, you miss it, bam, there's a groove. So I like that. So I carry a 58.
There you have it, folks. Try the new CBX full-face wedges from Cleveland Golf. I want to tell you about something else I saw at the PGA Merchandise Show. And that's me and my golf. And how does a 45-day free trial to Arcos sound? Well, me and my golf have partnered with Arcos and are offering 14 free sensors and a 45-day free trial to Arcos Caddy when you purchase any training aid on shop.meandmygolf.com. This is a limited time offer, so don't miss out. Again, go online to shop.meandmygolf.com. With many years in the business, menswear brand Construct has finally launched its Green Golf Collection, sustainably produced using renewable solar energy and recycled fabrics. Hit your best shot in their performance-enhancing polos, quarter zips, and bottoms, made with four-way stretch, quick dry, and UV 50-plus protection. From solids to bold, eye-catching designs, Construct Green is the perfect piece for making the best memories on the greens. And the best part? You can head to construct.com, and that's ConstructUCT.com, and use code Chris for 20% off the Green Collection today. Now back in making his seventh appearance with me here on Next on the Tee is a guy that I and my co-host Bob Lazzari over on our football show Thursday Night Tailgate, we think the world of, and that is Ross Greenberg. Like I mentioned earlier in the show, the last episode of a season is very special to me. I put extra thought into who are the last voices I want you to hear, because I hope those voices are going to resonate with you while we're all off celebrating for the holidays. So the guests tonight are all very meaningful to me, and they are people that I hope you say that guest was really something else. And I know you're going to do that with Ross Greenberg. He is one of just the absolute wonderful people that you get to meet in this life. He spent 33 years at HBO, served as vice president and executive producer of HBO Sports from 1985 to 1990, senior vice president and executive producer from 1990 to 2000, and president of HBO Sports from 2000 to 2011. He's produced the most incredible series in sports that I have ever seen. He did Sports of the 20th Century, as well as Sports with Bryant Gumbel, Inside the NFL, and HBO World Championship Boxing. He left HBO and created Ross Greenberg Productions and has made some of the best sports documentaries of this or any other time. He and his team are responsible for the all-access shows on Showtime, The Road to the Winter Classic, and Road to the Stanley Cup. He did a series for the USGA on Jack Nicklaus, plus Jack Nicklaus, The Making of a Champion for Fox. And those are just a few of the great documentaries that he has been a part of. He was also the executive producer of the movie Miracle about the 1980 U.S. hockey team. He's won well over 100 major television awards, and it is an incredible honor that I get to have him back with me here this week on Next on the Tee. Hey, Ross, thanks for coming back on the show.
I'm doing well, Chris. I have a little cold, so those of you who know me won't recognize the voice, but I'm here for you.
I appreciate you very much, Ross. Thanks for playing hurt.
Yeah, I'm playing hurt.
So, Ross, catch us up a little bit. What's been going on with you so far this year?
Well, first of all, Bill Russell on Netflix. If you haven't seen it, we just got honored by Sports Business Journal as the documentary of the year. So it's a very powerful, important film. And, you know, he was a good friend and he deserves this kind of treatment because very few athletes have ever had the impact that he has. And he was a wonderful man, wonderful human being, and very difficult to understand at times. But he made his presence known in the world of civil rights, and there'll never be anyone like him again. I'm also working on another film, which reminds me of Miracle in many ways. It's on the 1999ers, the women's soccer team that beat China and really changed the face of women's team sports. They were probably the first team that was recognized as real competitors. You know, they were title niners who had then taken the game to another level. And it hasn't looked back, and women's sports are blowing up now, as you know, in 2024. So, you know, we'll reminisce with Mia Hamm and Julie Foudy, and we have a writer who right now is sitting down with all of them to perfect the script, because you can't make a good movie out of a bad script. So we're very excited on that. We're not sure when it'll come out. We just have to make that script perfect. And I have another podcast at ESPN, which they haven't announced, so I can't announce it. It'll be a 30 for 30 podcast. And on the back end of it, it could become a miniseries, a scripted miniseries. So a lot of action going. Would love to get back into the world of golf, as you know. You know, I was reminiscing when you were talking to Mitch. My first job, or one of my first jobs in sports television, was as a spotter for Ben Wright. And before that, Henry Longhurst. And, you know, you guys took me back to that when he mentioned Ben's name. He was a real character, but there was no bigger character than Henry Longhurst, I'll tell you that.
Well, so let's take that a little bit further. Ben Wright was a wonderful friend of this show, and was on many, many times. And I like Mitch said, I echo what he said, and I miss his voice. I miss his, you know, everything about him, his friendship. He meant a great deal to me. And Henry Longhurst, as you know, I mean, those guys did the Masters together. They did a lot of broadcasts together over the years. So what was it like being kind of in between both of those guys?
Well, Henry was a character. I was on the 17th hole in the tower at Wingfoot, and Henry was getting older. It was the 1974 Wingfoot Massacre. And so we went up there on a Thursday, and finally, you know, on Friday we had a rehearsal, and someone said, look, you're going to have to help Henry up and down the scaffold, because in those days they were kind of tricky stairs, wasn't so great, and he was a little long in the tooth. So what I didn't realize was we got him up, and on Saturday and Sunday we literally had to carry him down, because when the television would go to commercial, Henry would pull out this little flask and take a hit. And so by the end of the day, you know, he was pretty plastered. but I will tell you, there was no greater sense of humor and no greater delivery with that English verbiage that was so rare. And he was so honest. Oh, he hit that one. You know, he just was very to the essence of every shot. So he was a wonderful human being, as was Ben Wright. Very similar senses of humor. Ben was very direct and candid and funny, and also had his way of delivering a line, and a British way, you know, not an American.
Ross, since we last spoke, this show has been picked up by my hometown newspaper, the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. You can find the show right there, front and center, on their digital sports page. And one of the films you did for the USGA was about the 1962 U.S. Open there at Oakmont, that duel between Jack Nicklaus and Arnold Palmer. It would become Jack's first major championship. Talk about that film and the dramatic 18-hole playoff they had.
I'll tell you that there are some days in my life on a set that I'll never forget. One of them would be wrapping up the movie 61 with Billy Crystal at Detroit's Tiger Stadium. But the second most memorable, and maybe the first most memorable day, was Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus. I got them together, and we needed to shoot the two of them on site at Oakmont. And Bob Ford, the legendary, you know, club pro, was so welcoming and warm to us. So the two of them took a helicopter, and the helicopter swoops in, they get out, and we start shooting them around the 10th tee, 9th green, you know, in that whole area, and had them walk the 18th hole together. You know, obviously had a lunch with them, which I'll never forget, in which everyone seemed to order Arnold Palmer's, which was fun. But there were a couple of moments. You want a really fun story? So on the 17th hole in 1962, Jack had a downhill 3.5 footer, which if he had missed, he probably wouldn't have, you know, gotten into the playoff with Arnold. So lo and behold, you know, I decide that we would bring the very putter that he used, the one that won 13 of 18 championships, or maybe it was 18. We brought the putter from a museum in Columbus to Oakmont. And the guy with the white gloves was there, you know, the guy who took all of this memorabilia away. And he handed the putter to Jack, and I wanted him to recreate the 3.5 footer. And so he got over it, and cameras rolling, and he hits the putt, and it goes straight into the middle of the hole. And I said, you know what? We're doing a take two just because, Jack, you're ridiculous. And so sure enough, we did a take two. He drained it again. We did a take three. He drained it again. He just drained like 10 in a row. And finally, at the end of that little shoot, he turns to the guy with the white gloves. I forgot his name. And he says, you know what? I may take this putter and put it in my bag. I forgot how great this putter was. And the guy with the white gloves goes, Jack, you're not taking that putter. It's $1 million. You're not taking a $1 million putter and putting it in your bag. That's one of the greatest stories I could ever tell in the history of sports television.
That's awesome.
I will. You want one more, Chris?
Please.
Okay. So later that day, we're shooting them on the 10th tee, and I want them to walk from the 10th tee down. So they're walking down, they walk back up, you know, and I do a few takes. And so all of a sudden, there was a women's tournament happening in the local Pittsburgh area, probably a pretty prestigious one, and they were good golfers. And so all of a sudden, I look back and I see on the ninth green, a twosome is done and finished and on their way to the 10th tee. And I said to Jack and Arnie, I said, you know what? Let's give these two women the thrill of their life. Why don't you guys just sit on the bench right in front of that tee and just, we'll just all watch as they tee off the 10th. And sure enough, the two women come by. And I swear to God, it's like a 605-yard par 5, by the way. And although from the women's tee, it's not, but we were at that tee. And so these women got to tee off. And by the way, both right down the middle, probably 40 yards. And Arnie and Jack were sitting on that bench smiling, and these two women had the moment of their life. And apparently there was a photographer there, and one of the women belonged to Oakmont. And at the end of the round, she had a photo of Jack and Arnie, you know, watching as she teed off.
Wow. That's awesome.
And I always imagined the dinner conversation with their husbands when they went home that night. Guess what, honey? Oh, how'd you do in the tournament? Well, forget the tournament. You know, guess what happened on the 10th hole?
That's fantastic. And Ross, I know you've spent a lot of time with Jack and Barbara Nicklaus over the years. What are some of the favorite stories when you were just sitting down, just chatting with Jack and Barbara? What are some of the great stories that you got to hear about?
Well, I mean, we were at the house in Jupiter a couple of times within like 3 months of each other. And he has this separate room where he has all of these, to be honest with you, the top layer is all the animals that he killed on many, many trips into the wild. And then, you know, it's a beautiful room and he likes to do the interviews there because it's so easy. So Barbara, you know, on a couple of these shoots, it was Jack and Barbara. And we did them separately, but they had a lot to talk about because, you know, the making of a champion, when we went through his life story, he had all these amazing stories of going to the 60 Open or the 62 Open. And we needed her there to kind of remind us, you know, of Jack's idiosyncrasies. The most memorable, I think, moment was when Barbara described the pants. He had a very severe case of doing everything the same way every time, every tournament. And he had one pair of pants that he liked to wear, kind of an off yellowish, brownish, whatever pair of pants. And for the four rounds at the 1962 Open, he wore those pants. And Barbara said, well, he damn well could have stood him up in the side of the room, you know, on Saturday, because they were so disgusting. And I just thought they were so down to earth and so much fun, but so sweet, both of them, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget, Jack is so funny, because before we'd sit down to do the interview, he'd always say, now, you know, I'm getting old. He was, let's say, 72, 74, 75 when I did those interviews. And he'd say, you know, I don't remember everything. So, you know, I'll give you as much as I got, but I don't remember anything, everything. And so sure enough, I'd sit down, start firing questions, and he'd know every shot at every golf tournament that he ever played. I mean, he's just amazing, amazing man.
You also told the story about the 1999 U.S. Open that Payne Stewart won. I've had a lot of Payne's contemporaries on the show, and they all speak so reverently about him and what a huge shock it was when we all learned about the plane crash.
Yeah.
Your film celebrated not only his win in that U.S. Open, but also the man that he was.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
Well, many people don't realize the man that he was. I mean, you know, he had a reputation of being a little aloof, cold. But in talking to his dear wife and, you know, all the players around him, there was a real love of the man. And he was a giving person. And no one was rooting harder for him than all of those other players that year. There was something about the magic of Payne and his charisma. You know, the one story that, you know, I remember getting a kick out of was when he showed up on that Sunday in 99. And it was kind of a hot, muggy, rainy day. And can you imagine fourth day of the U.S. Open? And he takes his scissors out and creates the first short sleeve windbreaker, you know, just with the scissors, chops the arms off. And wow. The way everyone talked about it was so much fun because he just didn't care. He just was going to do what was going to make him the best golfer. And by the way, you know, pretty pure swing too, huh?
Yeah, of course.
Wow.
One of the emotional moments in that docu was the salute the players did for him the next year at the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach. You had guys, you know, 41 players, I believe it was, hit that salute drive out into the ocean for him. Did you get an opportunity to speak to any one of those 41 players and how emotional it was for them to stand there and hit that shot?
Sure. We spoke to quite a few now. I can't remember off the top of my head some of the players, but I remember we spoke to quite a few of his contemporaries who had to hit that shot with tears rolling down their face. It was just incredibly emotional. On the 18th tee at Pebble Beach, think about it. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't get any more emotional than that. And I can't remember whose idea it was, but it was a great idea. And, you know, it became kind of an epic story in the history of the game.
Ross, you did a documentary on the 91 Ryder Cup, the War at the Shore.
Yeah.
And I've had Dave Stockton on this show, Mark Calcavecchia, Chip Beck, guys that played or coached, if you will, or managed it at that event. And what it was like trying to play at Kiawah at that time. It was a relatively new golf course and dealing with all the bugs, the no-see-ums. And the wind and everything that was a part of being in that 91 Ryder Cup. Talk about the things that you learned as you put that film together.
Well, I didn't, you know, I mentioned the wind only because I didn't realize how horrific the play was in terms of trying to battle the elements. You know, golf has a way about it, but in the Ryder Cup, you know, it's like everything's on the line. And you have to battle 40 mile an hour winds. And you have to, I remember, you know, the hole where if you started it in the middle of the fairway, the wind was blowing it into the water. So you had to actually aim way left of the fairway just to have the ends hit it straight in order for the ball to land in the fairway. And I, you know, I remember all those trees, you know, it was a new course, new design. They didn't have those waste areas prior to that as much. So all of a sudden players were playing out of bushes and it was just bizarre. And we had this one montage I'll never forget where we strung together about 12 of them in a row, watching the greatest golfers in the world look like they were 35 handicaps. And it was just amazing. I'll never, ever forget it. But the rivalry, you know, I don't think until I did the documentary, I realized how really difficult it was for the two teams to behave themselves because there was a lot of bitter kind of, you know, problems. Azinger and Seve, and, you know, there were some issues and things weren't, you know, there wasn't a camaraderie today. You can sense a little camaraderie, but then it was like, no, we have to win this. No, and it was really something. You'll never see that again. I mean, in sports, there's always going to be moments in sports history, like doing Miracle, you know, the 80 hockey game, where just because of the circumstances, you know, you can never get those circumstances to happen again. You know, I mean, think about how many years in a row the U.S. had won the Ryder Cup, and then all of a sudden they have to take it back. It's really something else.
Ross, just a couple more before I let you go. I want to switch sports on you. You've done a lot around the game of boxing. I know you were there in Tokyo for the Mike Tyson Buster Douglas fight. When you were around Mike during the days leading up to that fight, could you tell he wasn't ready for it?
No, it's funny. The day, another great story. Okay. So the day before the fight, we had started instituting a plan where we would meet with each fighter. The announcers. So in that particular case, Jim Lampley, myself, Larry Merchant, and Sugar Ray Leonard went to visit with Mike. And we got word Mike was starting to have issues with Larry at that time. So we got word that only you, Ross, and Sugar Ray are going to be invited up to Mike's room. So we get up to the room and Mike, hey, guys, come on in. Come here. I got to show you something. And so he takes us over the television, and it was a VHS recorder. And he said, take a look at this. Can you believe that? And he was watching a real-life death video.
Oh.
In other words, it was like an hour of strung together people that had been shot, had been drowned, had died in a variety of ways. It was real-life death. And Sugar Ray and I looked at each other and went, whoa, okay. This is not good for Buster Douglas. And then we went to Buster Douglas' room after that with Larry and Jim, filled them in on Mike's take of the fight. And then we go to Buster's room, and he sounds like me right now. He had the worst head cold I think I've ever heard in my life. And we left that meeting, and I said, but he talked very emotionally about the loss of his mother 2 weeks prior. And we knew he was trained and ready. He was a guy that, you know, would put on a lot of pounds between fights, but he looked in unbelievable shape. And so sure enough, the next day, I turned to the announcers when we left his room. I said, this is going to be a massacre. This is a disaster. And he was 42-1 underdog. So we get there the next day, and all of a sudden, Tyson walks to the ring, and he looks a little out of sorts. Douglas enters the ring, and he looks like a focused, you know, just a magical moment in his life was about to end. And so sure enough, Tyson's pacing in the ring. The first 30 seconds of the fight happen, and Buster Douglas hits him with a straight left jab. I'll never forget this. And I hit Jim Lampley's IFB, which is how producer talks to talent. And I said, Jim, we've got a fight here. Because I had never seen Tyson get hit by a jab like that. And his head was stationary. And then the rest is history.
Ross, before I let you go, remind our listeners again, how can we stay up to date with all the great things you're doing on your website? Plus, how can we watch all the great things that you're going to be coming out with in 2024?
Okay, so look for ESPN to make an announcement on their 30 for 30 podcast, which they will do probably in February. You will know Netflix has already announced the 99ers film, so I'm sure once we start production, you'll hear of that. I would hope we start that in the spring or summer. And then, of course, you know, Netflix will continue to herald, you know, Bill Russell because it didn't win that best documentary award, and will be up, I hope, for some Emmys and stuff. And you can always go to RossGreenbergProductions.com. It's a pretty healthy website. It'll show everything I've done in the past and everything we're going to be doing in the future.
Ross, I can't thank you enough for playing her tonight and coming back and being a part of the show. As I said to you, and I've been saying all along tonight's episode, the voices on the last show of any season are ones that I really think about, and because I want them to be important, I want them to resonate with my listeners long after they've listened to the show. And I want them to be somebody who has been very important to me over the years. And you have been so gracious with your time. Again, this is the seventh time I've had an opportunity to sit down with you and talk with you about your great career and the great things that you've done. But thank you so very much for all that you have meant to me on this show on Thursday Night Tailgate. And I hope we get that privilege of catching up with you again in 2024.
You got me, Chris, always. You know that. I really feel the same way about you.
Thank you, Ross. Happy holidays to you and your family. We'll catch up again soon.
Thank you.
See you, Ross. That is the great Ross Greenberg, folks. And just like Mitch before him, one of the great people you get to meet in this life. He has done so many outstanding films and documentaries. Very much looking forward to watching the Bill Russell one. Haven't had an opportunity to plug that one in, but as a guy who spent a lot of years in Boston in the 80s, Bill Russell reverberated, even though that was long past his playing career. He always was a part of what was the old garden. And in Boston Celtic lore, obviously, he'll live in there forever. But very much looking forward to that. Looking forward to finding out what's going on with the 30 for 30 podcast and then the 99ers over there on Netflix. All things that I will be watching over this holiday season. And very much looking forward to having Ross back as part of the show in the new year. Coming up next is going to be a guy I've been very excited to have as part of the show. He is a former Florida State amateur champion, a medalist at Q School, a three-time winner out there on the PGA Tour, and a heck of a nice guy. His name is David Peoples. Before I get to David, I want to remind you about 2-Under, men's performance wear. They're the unofficial underwear of the PGA and the 2020 Ryder Cup team. Ricky Fowler is their global ambassador, and over 50 other PGA, Korn Ferry, and Champions Tour players wear them. Just to mention a few, like David Toms, Jerry Kelly, Justin Thomas, William McGirt, Scott McCarron, and Chris DeMarco. The Joey Pouch technology provides the ultimate male asset management, delivering maximum comfort from the tee box to the boardroom to the bedroom. Use code NXTONTEE20, so next on T20, to save 20% at checkout. So go to 2under.com, that's a number 2UNDR.com, 2under, performance in your pants.
Relax. Easy now. Find your happy place. It's all in the hips. Just tap it in.
Yes!
Find the latest clubs and apparel at Golf's Happy Place, the PGA Tour Superstore.
Okay, now making his Next on the Tee debut with me is David Peoples. I wanted David to be a part of the final episode of this season for a few reasons. First, he shares the same birthday with my middle daughter, January 9th. He's from Augusta, Maine, and Maine is one of my favorite places on the planet. We've lived in the same city twice, Winter Park, Florida, and Germantown, Tennessee. Beyond those things, here's more about his background. David played his college golf at the University of Florida from 1979 to 1981, where he helped them win the Florida Intercollegiate and Dixie Intercollegiate Tournament. And he teamed with some great players while he was there, like our good friend Mark Calcavecchia. In 1979, David won the Florida State Amateur Championship. He turned pro in 81. He was the medalist at Q School in 1989. He won twice out on the PGA Tour at the 1991 Southern Open and the 92 Anheuser-Busch Classic. He also won the 1990 Kapalua International, which was a non-PGA Tour sanctioned event, but it had an incredible field filled with PGA Tour legends, and he won that tournament by 5 strokes over Davis Love III. Over the course of his playing career, in addition to those 3 wins, he had 4 runner-up finishes, 5 third-place finishes, 23 top fives, and 37 top tens, and I couldn't be more excited that I get to have him with me this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, David, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, Chris, thanks for having me. Boy, this is a tough act to follow. Mitch and Ross, that was amazing.
I appreciate that very much. But let's go back to your early days, because Maine, like I say, is one of my favorite places on the planet. How long did you live in Augusta?
I think maybe about 6 or 7 months.
Wow, not long at all.
Not long at all. My parents moved down to Orlando, and then I was in Orlando for 46 years of my life.
So University of Florida, was that it for you? Is that the place that you were going to play college golf come hell or high water? Because I have to imagine there were a bunch of other colleges looking to recruit you.
Well, pretty much. Yeah. I mean, I had my heart set on it. It was sort of like a little dream there that you have, you know, playing, being a Gator and playing for a school like that. It was really cool. Before that, Hal Sutton had given me a call and asked if I wanted to come to Centenary. So I took the trip up and, you know, we did the tour of the campus and everything. It was very nice. And especially, you know, being Hal Sutton, it was, you know, really nice, but, not quite University of Florida.
You were there at the same time as another great friend of this show, Mark Calcavecchia. What was it like for you teaming up with Mark?
Oh, it was great. It was great. He got there, I think, a year before me, and I'm pretty sure he was the SEC Freshman of the Year or something, you know, and it was just great getting to play with all those players. You know, we had a good team. We didn't really gel very much as a team, but we had a lot of fun along the way. That's for sure.
Rick Pearson was also one of your teammates. He was an All-American medalist at the 1980 SEC Championship, won 3 times on what's now the Corn Ferry Tour. And today is his birthday, oh, by the way. Tell us about Rick.
Rick was the leader of our team. He was definitely the best player on the team. You would think it would be Calc, but Calc hadn't quite, you know, gotten to his level at that point. Rick was just he was like a robot, man. I mean, he's just this stocky guy, and he'd set up to the ball, and he'd hit this nice little 10-yard draw every shot. And just a great, great player. We all had attitude problems, you know, and clubs got flying lessons quite a few times with that that crew.
So let's take that a step further, because I heard a story and I wanted to see if it was true, because after one of your tournaments, I heard he putted so poorly that he tied his putter to the back of the team van. And when asked what he was doing, he said, "It let me down so badly, I'm going to drag it all the way back to Gainesville."
That's Pierce. That sounds like Pierce. It sounds like Calc too. Actually, it sounds like a lot of guys on that team. I tell you, once we were playing, we used to play these things called the Orange and Blues. Those were our qualifying rounds. And I got paired with Calc and Larry Rents. And, you know, we're going off the 16th tee. And this is a year after Calc had already kind of messed up a little bit at the NCAA tournament, going off and destroying a garbage can and gallery posts and all that sort of stuff. And I was right behind him witnessing the whole thing. Well, anyway, we're back in Gainesville and qualifying, and we all tee off, and I'm the first walking off the tee. I'm probably 30 yards ahead of the guys, and here comes two drivers, Worley Burton, right over my head. I just turned around like, are you kidding me? Anyway, the ladies coach, Mimi Ryan, up at the tee, saw some of the antics that was going on, and escorted Calc off the course again. Just like what happened at the Ohio State Scarlet. Yeah, it was hilarious.
Speaking of Larry Rents, I heard a story about him sneaking over to try out with the Gator football team. He wanted to see if he could be a punter, and he did so well that he got into a final putt-off with another guy until someone went and told your coach what was going on, and he went over and pulled Larry out of there because he was too valuable to the golf team. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah, that's definitely, I hadn't heard that one, but I know for sure that our quarterback, Bob Huco, they were kind of, you know, horsing around at the golf course, and I think he ran into Larry, and Larry was a big, strong guy, and Larry didn't move, and Huco went down, and and I think Huco basically said, please don't tell anybody that this happened. So we lost our quarterback for a few weeks on that one.
Oh,
yeah. And Larry could punt the ball. I mean, we used to call him the animal. He was the animal.
You guys played against a lot of great players during your college days from other schools. I know Paul Azinger was at Florida State during that time. What was the rivalry like between University of Florida and Florida State and playing against Zinger?
You know, we never really, I didn't seem like we crossed paths much. You know, Zinger went to his freshman year, he went to Brevard Community College over in Cocoa area. And I went to Valencia in Orlando for my freshman year. And they were Brevard, where Zinger played, they had an A team and a B team, and Zinger didn't make the A team. He was on the B team, and he wasn't shooting very good scores. You know, he wasn't, I don't know if he started late or what the deal was, but next year comes around, and you know, he's at Florida State. And from that point forward, I have never seen anyone improve at such a fast rate of pace as he did. He, you know, Pierce and I were up there, I think, in Atlanta Athletic Club trying to qualify for, it was either U.S. Open or the U.S. Amateur, I'm not sure which. And we looked on the board, and it had, you know, how all the guys got there, advanced on to the, where we were at that time, at that, which stage we were in. And there was Zinger up there, won by like five shots. And every time I looked after that, he was right up there. He went on to qualify. I think he won medalist the first time he tried the Q school, and rest is history.
As you saw when you checked out the show, Tom Patry is a regular guest here with me. When some guys see that TP has been on the show 89 times now, they kind of look at me with their heads a little cocked, wondering what I'm thinking. So I, first of all, thank you for not doing that. But you guys were in college at the same time. He was at Florida Southern, not all that far away from Gainesville. Did you get to know Tom at all while you guys were competing in college or afterwards?
Yeah, we did. Some of the amateur tournaments, I think I got to meet Tom. And I think more so, though, on the mini tours, like the Space Coast Tour and stuff like that. And then as the years went through, you know, my first year on the Champions Tour, down in Naples, Florida, I ran into him down there, and you know, he helped me with my golf swing a little bit, and it was really good. Got to go to dinner with him and his wife Denise, and that was great. So, as actually, you know, coming up, we're hoping to move down to Naples. We got a little condo down there, and you know, whenever time comes for my wife to retire, we're gonna try to settle down there. So maybe I can run into Tom a little more.
There you go. Let's go back.
Either that or avoid him.
Indeed. Let's go back and talk about your wins on the PGA Tour. And the first one came at Kapalua in November of 1990. 5-stroke victory over Davis Love III in that one. You shot 63 in the first round, never looked back. Talk about getting your first win and doing it over a tremendous field. Not only Davis Love finishing second, Nick Price was third. There are a lot of legends out in that golf tournament. Talk about that.
Yeah, that was a sort of a culmination of that year, 1990. I mean, before that, I had gone to the tour school so many times. I think I counted them today. I actually went and looked them back up. I got through that thing 7 different times. So I'd get in my car, lose my car, get it. And anyway, I finally got to 1990, and I played really well. I think I made 26 cuts out of 32 events, and I was just playing really, really well, and I just caught lightning in a bottle, I guess, that particular week. Played like I knew what I was doing. I actually made it through the Q school 7 times. I finished the first one. I finished 14 shots behind Donnie Hammond. He beat me by 14, and I finished second all by myself. So that just tells you the kind of week he had.
We've talked to Donnie several times about that week. So yes, that was something.
Yeah, that was incredible. But anyway, that Kapalua for me was, you know, to win that tournament by 5 shots with Nick Price and Tom Pertzer and just a whole bunch of really good players. I think everybody was taking their time at the beach, though, and just let me go.
Your second win came at the Buick Southern Open in 1991, just a little south of me here in Atlanta, Callaway Gardens in Pine Mountain, Georgia. This time you beat Robert Gomez by a stroke. He was the rookie of the year in 1990. You were tied for the lead after the first round. You trailed Gomez and Larry Nelson by 3 going into that final round. But you shoot 66. You overtake him. What do you remember about that week?
You know, I remember finishing the third round and going to the range to, you know, hit a few balls. And I really didn't have a lot to work on, but I just should cool down, I guess. And it was the first time I really thought about winning, you know, and I said, you need to think, because I always kind of avoided that thought, you know, because I choked my guts out. So I just said, you know, you need to embrace this, and you need to think about winning. And man, I tell you what, it really made all the difference. I went out and started out like a house of fire, and and kept it up. And I think I went bogey free that day and shot 66. And so, you know, I always was a little on the timid side. And when I'd get up there, I didn't want to think about, you know, winning or any of those kind of things. But it turned out that you really do need to, you need to face the music, you know, and step up.
And as I recall, when I was doing the research on that tournament, not only did all of that happen, but you also had to battle the elements that day. I think you guys had about an hour and 13 minute right. lightning delay. So right. you had a lot of things going on around you.
Yeah, that was tough. You know, we made it to the ninth green, finished the ninth hole, and it finished up right at the clubhouse. And then they called it, and we all went into the clubhouse, you know. And, you know, everybody's trying to talk to you. I mean, I'm looking for a locker to climb into to just so I don't have to talk to anybody. You know, I'm so nervous. It's unbelievable. And then it was finally time to go back out, and I managed to stay away from everybody and played pretty darn good down the stretch, except for those last two.
David, at the PGA Tour level, the game feels upside down to me right now. With everything that's going on between the proposed merger between the PGA Tour and the PIF, and LIV going out and buying John Rahm, everything that's happening right now, the loss of trust between the players and the executives at the PGA Tour level, Jay Monahan and his folks, trust between us and the players, everything seems to be upside down. I want to get your thoughts on what you're seeing going on right now.
Well, you know, like Mitch said, I don't begrudge anybody, you know, trying to make a living, and I tried to do it and did my best at it, but it felt like a gut punch, really, when I heard the news about John Rahm going over, because he seemed to be so adamant about, you know, staying in support of the PGA Tour. And, you know, that old saying, everybody's got a number. Well, I guess that we found out what his was. So, you know, the PGA Tour is, it always seemed like things were going to work out. This is a different feeling. You know, before you always feel like you felt like, you know, this is all going to come out in the wash, you know, because they've always, yeah, they always have looked after us very well. But this is a totally different deal. And yeah, it doesn't look good.
David, when I was looking back again over the course of your career, I know you played really well here at Callaway Gardens, winning that tournament in 91. The year before, in 1990, the tournament was held at Green Island Country Club. You went out there in the second round, shot 62. Is that the best round that that you ever played?
Yeah, that was pretty good. That was a pretty good one. I think I shot, in relation to par, I think at the the Bank of Boston Classic at Pleasant Valley, I shot 63, but that was a par 72. So that was 9 under, as opposed to the 62 at Green Island. It was a par 70, I'm thinking. And so it was an 8 under round. So I go with the one at Pleasant Valley.
So when you think back on your career, What are the tournaments? What are the events? What are the things that you got to be a part of that, as you reflect on them, still make you smile to this day?
Boy, I tell you, pretty much, you know, every one of the Q schools that I made it through, because that really is a brutal tournament to go through. And we just got to see some of it this past weekend when they're playing at Sawgrass like we did before. But, you know, winning the tournament at Kapalua, I think, was the crowning jewel for me. I've never been to that island before, and just to have a week like that was about as good as it gets.
Do you have a favorite shot that you think about that, boy, that was just so pure, that was just such a big moment that you rolled a putt, you made a shot, whatever it was? Is there something that sticks out to you?
I do remember making a hole in one at Hartford. And they had I think Buick was sponsoring the hole or something. And it was, you know, you win the car if you get a hole in one. It was a 4 iron. It was a long shot. And I thought for sure I had that car. And I didn't. I think it was John Adams ahead of me. Two groups ahead of me made the same shot.
No.
And yeah. Yeah. So I was just looking to see if I could get a hubcap or something, you know.
Right. You deserve that.
That was brutal.
No doubt. Fred Ridley, who's obviously the chairman of Augusta National, is also a former Gator or Gator alumni. Has that helped at all? Has Fred been amenable to get you out on Augusta National?
Absolutely not.
No?
No. No, no, but he seems like a really good guy, though. You know, he's doing a heck of a job. Oh, after winning that, you know, the Southern Open, I got to go to the Masters. And that was the big deal about that whole thing was winning that tournament in Columbus, Georgia, there at Callaway Gardens. Is, you know, if you win that event, where the Kapalua tournament didn't come with that invite, but the tournament at Callaway did, the Southern Open, and I was in the clubhouse and finished, and here comes Robert Gomez was making a little charge, and he hit it in there about 10 feet on the last hole, and man, I tell you, that was the most lonely feeling, standing there on the putting green, watching him from about 50 yards away. And you have no control over what that guy does. And I'm like, if he makes this, I'm probably going to make 10 on the first playoff hole. So I'm definitely not going to win. You know, all those positive thoughts going through my head. And sure enough, he just lipped it out. He hit a great putt. And then you realize I get to play Augusta National. And that was just an incredible feeling.
So what was it like when the invitation came in the mailbox?
No, it was unbelievable. Just, I didn't really know anything about the invitations. And then there was just this beautiful, envelope and the invitation, the whole nine yards. It was just, it was great. This is the whole different level of golf right there. That's for sure. You know, I can remember playing practice rounds there, and I didn't want to leave the golf course. I just wanted to keep playing. And my caddy and I, we just kept going around and around and around. And we happened to do this on the day that the par three tournament was, and they closed the course. I didn't know that. And I was getting ready to go off number one again. He said, sir, the course is closed now. The next day was actually the real tournament. And I was going to play till dark.
Until they drug you off the golf course?
Until they drug me off. I mean, it's the most beautiful course I've ever seen. And, you know, after watching it all those years and just watching all the great tournaments with Jack and Gary Player and Watson and all of them, and then you're there, you're actually there. It's surreal.
Was it what you expected? Because for all the years that I watched the tournament, and I've been blessed to be out on the property every year since 2001, but prior to that, TV just doesn't do justice to what that golf course A looks like, and B, the elevation changes are unbelievable. Was it what you expected, or was it very different for you as well?
No, I was amazed at the elevation changes. I couldn't believe how hard the 18th hole was. You know, I mean, that hitting off of a lie like that into basically a blind green, you could see the top of the flag a little bit, but it was incredibly difficult. And number 11, also, I was like, now I know why everybody hits it way over there to the right. It's either over there or it's in the water, you know? And, I mean, that hole is incredibly intimidating. It was, I always thought, you know, because, you know, in the older days, before I got there, the whole thing was mowed to fairway length, I think. And then I guess it had been a couple of years before I got there that they actually grew a little bit of rough, but it really wasn't anything terrible. It you might catch a little bit of a flyer or something like that, but it was still a pretty darn good lie, you know. And anyway, my first year there, I was paired with Billy Mayfair and I think it was D.A. Wybring, and we were the last group. We were the only threesome on the golf course, and we were the very last ones. So everybody had finished, and I'm telling you, we're a good six groups behind. So there's nobody out there, and the 4-0 guys are in a big V shape following us down the fairway, because apparently I guess we were pretty slow. We never got timed though or anything, but I guess just because we were the only threesome on the course. But it was such a weird feeling. There was nobody there. We get down to the 15th green, go across the, there's nobody in the stands. Now that was a little disappointing.
David, whether it was in a practice round or maybe away from a tournament proper, who are the guys that you really enjoyed playing with and who kept you rolling while you were out there?
You know, that's a good question. I always tried to get out by myself. I always kind of kept to myself a little bit. But I used to love playing with Rick Fair, just a good guy. You know, I've seen where he's been on the show a time or two.
Yeah.
You know, Chris, for the most part, I honestly just tried to stick it out and get out there and get my job done and get out of there.
You played for a little bit out there on the Champions Tour. What was it like going from being on the PGA Tour and that transition over to the Senior Tour?
Well, it was great because, you know, I couldn't, I actually had to play leading up to being 50, play on the Korn Ferry Tour. It was called something different at that time, but it was very difficult, you know, getting out driven by 50 yards every hole by those young bucks. but getting to play on the Champions Tour was just amazing. The courses were a little more suited for what our capabilities were, you know, and all that. And, I got off to a really good start. Had some top tens and, I really enjoyed myself there. My whole game plan was to be out there for about 10 years, but only made it three before the arthritic back started acting up. So that was the end of that. But, you know, when you don't play for a while, you know, you lose your speed. So I've tried to play these days. I'm still trying to play recreational golf. I mean, I'd love to do that because I just love the game so much. But it's a little on the painful side. It's not easy getting old, is it?
I hear you.
Beats the alternative, though.
And indeed it does. David, before I let you go, let everyone know what you're doing now.
Well, I'm pretty much just retired. Just waiting on Kimmy, my wife, to retire and get on down to Naples. And there's a golf course, it seems like, on every corner. So I'll probably find my way out to one of them.
How can our listeners stay up to date with you, whether it's following you online or it's on social media?
Well, Chris, I just get on Facebook, you know, and nose around there and see what's going on. So I guess at Facebook could probably be where you could find me, Dave Peoples. Yeah, I'm really not tech savvy at all. It's a good thing my wife's here. I don't think I would have figured this thing out.
Well, my thanks to her. David, well, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your night to come and be a part of the show. You're a treasure, my friend. I hope we get this privilege. I feel like we've probably just scratched the surface of the great things that you've done over the course of your career in the game. I hope, like I say, we get the privilege of having you back on again as we get into 2024.
Chris, I would love that. And thank you so much for the invite. It's been great. And I really look forward to seeing you.
Thank you very much. David, take care. Merry Christmas. Happy holidays to you and your family. I look forward to catching up with you again soon.
You bet. You bet.
See you, David.
See you, Chris.
That is the great David Peoples, folks, and just a wonderful guy. How great was that conversation and the things that he has done? Again, a guy that that won two times on the PGA Tour, a third that wasn't a sanctioned event, but probably a tougher field that he had to overcome. And that one, 5 third place finishes, 23 top 5, 37 top 10s, and just has done a lot of great things in and around the game. So the time at Florida, unbelievable with the guys that he got to be teammates with and the things that they got themselves into and out of. So I'm sure we'll talk more about that and get Mark Calcavecchia's perspective on some of that as well. But David is great. And like I say, we've lived in the same city a couple of different times, had some similar experiences. So I'm very thankful for him for coming and being a part of the show. And like I say, we'll catch up with him again in 2024. Folks, before I close up shop tonight, you've heard me talk about some great products that I saw at the PGA Merchandise Show. And another one that stood out to me is On Point Golf. Game-changing, three-dimensional ball markers that science shows will help us see the line better when we're putting and therefore make more putts and lower our scores. See for yourself why Jim Furyk and I are big fans by going online to onpointgolf.us. All right, my friends, it is time for me to put a bow on this season of Next on the Tee. My sincere thanks again to Mitch Lawrence, Ross Greenberg, and David Peoples for closing out season number 10 with me this week. I'll be taking next week off, but we'll be back with you the first week in January. And scheduled to kick off 2024 with us will be our resident director of instruction, Tom Patry, of course, will be here. LPGA Tour Pro Megan Francella will be making her next On the Tee debut with me that week. We'll also get a return visit from Dr. Bob Winters, who was fantastic when he joined me on the show not all that long ago. And then also making her Next on the Tee debut will be former LPGA Tour pro and now broadcaster Jane Crafter. So, folks, it's going to be a great way to kick off 2024. I hope you'll tune in and join us. As you know, you can find this show available as a podcast just about anywhere you get your podcast content. In particular, we're out there on TribLive.com and the Pittsburgh Tribune Review site. So just go to TribLive.com, click on Sports, and then Podcast, and you're going to find Next on the Tee available for you free, front and center, right there on that page. You can also find the show on Good Pods, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Audio Boom, and Player.fm. And as always, my thanks to the folks over at Good Pods for making this show one of their recommended podcasts and a staff pick. Please download their free app and stream your favorite podcast right there on your favorite device. But as always, most of all, my sincere thanks to all of you for being the greatest supporters in the history of podcasts. I appreciate you all so very much. Merry Christmas, happy holidays, and happy new year to you and yours. Until next time, hit 'em straight, my friends.